Now it is my privilege to introduce tonight's speaker, so please offer a warm Valley Group welcome to JC.
Hi, I am an alcoholic and my name is JC. And I want to thank Bill for asking me to speak tonight. Appreciate that a lot. I want to thank all the people that helped set up this meeting. These meetings don't set up themselves. There's a lot of stuff that goes on behind the curtains. I want to thank everybody that helped set it up. Thank Joe for the coffee. It was very good, very strong. Got me shaking. Congratulations to all the chip takers. Welcome to any newcomers. Thank you to all the old timers and the in-betweeners. Everybody's helped me stay sober. And I was told I couldn't stay sober, but we could stay sober. I'm a little nervous. I'm not a very polished public speaker, but one of my spiritual mentors told me, just try not to suck. So that's, if I can do that, I'll be okay. So anyway, as I said, I am a real alcoholic. I think it was Libby that read the chapter 3, and that opening sentence says, most of us are unwilling to admit we are real alcoholics. And that's probably a big part of my story. You know, this is a disease of denial. Today, I admit that I'm a real alcoholic. And I also want to say, I'm not a practicing alcoholic. I'm a recovered alcoholic. I'm recovered. I'm not cured. I'll always be an alcoholic, but I never have to drink again. And when I got to this program, I could not stop drinking. I was a hopeless alcoholic, and I didn't understand that. I knew I was a drunk. I knew that I got drunk quite often. I knew that I got drunk quite often when I wasn't going to get drunk. I knew I picked up that. I always found a reason to pick up that first drink, no matter how many reasons I had not to. My mind was alcoholic. It would convince me to take that first drink, no matter what. And no matter what had gone on before, no matter what kind of consequences I was facing, no matter what kind of problems I had, no matter how many reasons I had to not take that drink, my mind always convinced me to take that first drink. And what happened when I took that first drink was I could not control how much I drank after I took that first drink. And that's a real alcoholic. I wanted to think I was just a party guy, you know. Sex, drugs, and rock and roll, you know. A lot of booze. And, of course, I think of booze as a drug. So, but, you know, I wasn't a party guy. The party was down to one. Me. And the party was just me getting drunk and getting sloppy and getting belligerent, getting blacked out, getting in trouble, getting arrested, getting in fights. I just become a stumbling, bumbling, babbling drunk. And like I said, it didn't matter what I said I was going to do. I would take that first drink and then I couldn't control how much I drank afterwards. I started drinking when I was about 13 or 14 years old. And like so many of us, I met a lot of people that started a lot younger, and I met a lot of people that started a lot later, but that seems to be a pretty much a norm, 13, 14 years old. And I liked it right from the beginning. As soon as I took that very first drink, when there was enough around to where I could drink as much as I wanted to, that's what I did. I just started drinking as fast as I could. I'd had a few sips of booze before, and I didn't really like it, and I couldn't really see why you do it. But this day, I was with a bunch of guys, and we got some older guy to get us a few cases of beer, and we went, jumped over a fence and got into a junkyard, and we were drinking this beer. And after the first beer or two, I just started slamming them. And that first day, that very first drunk, I liked it immediately. I felt like somebody that I'd never felt like before. And I felt like somebody that I really liked. I felt like somebody that I was really comfortable with. I didn't even know that I had any kind kind of psychological, social problems. But that day, I felt ways that I'd never felt before. And I remember I was talking, I was to everybody, I was singing, I was dancing, I was fighting, I was swimming in a ditch. I got arrested, I got dragged home by the cops, I got the belt from the old man, and then I got grounded by the old lady, and I woke up the next day, and all I could think about was how wonderful that was. You know, I had a black eye, I had cracked ribs, I had a lot of problems, but I loved the way that felt, and I couldn't wait to do it again. I remember calling a friend saying, I couldn't wait to do that again. And now, normal people don't do that. I've met a lot of people over the years that they drink and they have some kind of problem, and they don't drink like that again, or they quit drinking or whatever. It did something for me. It made me feel like somebody I'd never felt before. And like I said, I didn't know that I had any issues when I was 13 years old. I was just a dumb country kid who had moved out of East Texas into Houston, Texas. And I was starting to run with a rougher crowd instead of the country crowd that I'd run with. I didn't know that I felt like I didn't fit in. I didn't know that I felt less than. I didn't know that I felt had low self-esteem. I didn't know that I was insecure. I didn't know that I had a problem with girls. I didn't know I had all this stuff. I didn't know that I had all these different fears and stuff. But when I woke up that next day, and I remembered how I felt the night before, and then I felt the way that I normally felt the next day, there was a huge difference. There was a huge difference. When I drank, I suddenly felt like on a scale of 1 to 10, I felt like something between an 8, 9, and a 10. And when I was sober the next day, all of a sudden I realized I'm feeling like a 2. I feel like a 2. And there's a huge difference between a 1 or a 2 and a 10. That was a huge difference, man. That gave me a lot of incentive to get more of this stuff into my system. A normal person, they might run around feeling like a 6 or 7, maybe an 8, whatever. They drink, they bump up a notch. No big deal. For me, it was a big deal because I bumped up a lot of notches. And I liked it. And being intoxicated. I didn't like being sober. And right from the beginning, that's how I attacked this thing. I was all in. I was all in. Put me in this game. I'm going to play it. And I got into all that other stuff. There's all this other stuff out there. And I liked other stuff too. And there wasn't anything that I didn't like. You know, if it made me feel different, if it made me feel better, it was okay. And it didn't even have to make me feel good a lot of times. I would just do stuff to feel better. If it made me feel good, that was great. You know, if it made me feel gooder, that was even greater. With me, because I was all in. And I like a lot of, maybe a lot of y'all, maybe not everybody, but a lot of y'all, I grew up in a home where there was alcoholism. I'd seen alcoholism since I was a young kid. My stepdad was alcoholic, and he would get pretty nasty when he was drinking. He was very belligerent, obnoxious, could be very aggressive, could be brutal at times, I didn't like that, I wasn't going to drink. I was going to be that good kid that wasn't going to drink. And I never could understand why he did it, And my mom always said, your dad, he's an alcoholic. Called him my dad, even though I'm a stepdad. He's an alcoholic. And what he needs to learn to do is how to control his drinking. And that stuck in my head, And so once I drank and I felt how it feels, I wanted to drink then. But I still wasn't going to be like him. But, I'm young. That's a long time ago. I'm young and 14, going up to 15. I'm drinking. I've got a big chip on my shoulder. I've got a lot of anger issues. The testosterone's kicking in, and the booze and drugs are kicking in. I'm hanging around with a lot of the neighborhood tough guys and stuff. I'm getting into trouble. I'm starting to get into more and more trouble. And the more I drink and use, the more trouble I'm getting into. And where I'd been a fairly good kid up to that time. Now I'm getting to be a problem. I'm a problem for the neighborhood. I'm a problem for society. I'm a problem for the school. I'm a problem for my family. I'm just becoming a problem kid. And the more I drank and used, the wilder I get, and the more I wanted to get on the wild side, and the less I was attracted to anything society had. And so I quit school. I quit school. I was getting kicked out all the time anyway, and I quit and took a minimum wage job, but I had other ways to make money, and so I was doing other things too, but working, and I told my mom I'd quit school and I'd help support her, you know, and I think I kind of meant it when I said it, but when I started working and I was kind of freed up, you know, I just left home pretty soon. I didn't help support my mom. And I've always regretted that, you know. But, you know, it's hard to do a lot of the things that you do. It's hard to keep a lot of the promises. I was always angry at my stepdad because he couldn't keep his promises. He always made promises, and then he couldn't keep up with them because of the drinking. Maybe it was the next day, you know, he was hungover. Maybe the next day he didn't have any money. Maybe the next day he wasn't there, whatever, you know, or he just took off and got drunk. You know, so he was always breaking promises, you know. Now I'm doing this stuff. The stuff that I didn't like about him, I'm doing it, you know. I'm not a man of my word at all, you know. And so I start getting into a lot of legal problems. I'm hanging around with a real rough group. I'm a high school dropout, you know. I'm using all kinds of hard drugs and drinking a lot and just doing a lot of stuff and getting into a lot of trouble. And you know, what do you do with people like that? Now you got to lock them up. You got to lock them up, and they start doing that with me. And so even early on, I started realizing I had a problem. And some of that, a little bit of that good guy that's deep down inside, you know, he was trying to convince me at times to do the right thing. But I could never listen to that guy. I was always listening to the bad guy on this shoulder, not the good guy over here on this shoulder. So I'd try to cut back on some of this stuff, and I couldn't. The same thing always happened. I would say I was only going to drink a six-pack or three or eight or whatever. And as soon as I took one in, I was off and running. There was no slowing down. And the same thing with all that other stuff, you know. And then when you drink like that, you're more or less crazy drunk, more or less insane drunk and stoned. So I couldn't follow through on anything, and the consequences were stacking up. The state of Texas put me in a drug and alcohol treatment center when I was 17. And that was my first association with AA. Not much association. I'd heard about AA through my stepfather. He was forced to go through it a little while earlier, a couple years before. And I remember I was thinking he was a bad alcoholic, but then he talked about these AA people like, you guys were really bad alcoholics. and so when I went to this drug and alcohol treatment center, they asked us, the kids, they had the alcoholics, the straight alcoholics who were older people, then they had all the young people that were alcoholic and drug addicts, and they asked us if we wanted to go to the AA meeting, and my impression, I thought, man, I don't want to go to that. That sounds horrible. I could picture in my mind just a bunch of guys in like black trench coats with hat, like raincoats with hats pulled down and sunglasses, Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, it just sounded like the most horrible place. And no, I did not want to go there. I jumped the fence and got some other stuff and got kicked out of that treatment center. And then by the time I was 18, the state put me in the state mental hospital in Austin and said I had to be crazy to be doing the stuff I was doing, you know. And I was put in the Texas State Prison Farm System several times, and so it just was all piling up. And then I met the perfect woman, you know. I met her, and she was 17, and I was 18, and she ran away from home and moved in with me. And a few weeks later, her father and her brother showed up in my apartment, basically kicked the door down. They had 38s, and they said they were going to kill me for ruining their daughter. And she had been well ruined before I met her. But anyway, I was getting the blame, and you know, I'm a pretty slow fellow, but every now and then my brain clicks fast, and I told those two guys that had 38 stuck up to me that I was in love with their daughter and their sister, and I wanted to marry her. And they put the guns back in their waistbands and said, "Welcome to the family." And that's how I got married the first time. They call that a shotgun wedding, but it's more like a 38 wedding, double 38. But for some reason, we were broke up after 6 months. I don't know what happened, you put booze in me and everything looked good. And I was not marriage material, not at all. So that marriage was on and off, and didn't last too long. Then I knew I had to get straightened up. My life was a wreck. I think my family, my stepfather had been in the Coast Guards, my real father had been in the Army. He'd been killed in the war. And I had family that was military, and they said, you ought to join the military. And I said, okay, I'll go join the Army. I want to be a Ranger. He said, no. Our family goes in the Navy. You're going to go in the Navy if you want to go. That's the way to go. You don't want to go in the Army. So anyway, I tried to join the Navy, and actually I tried to join everybody. Nobody would take me. Nobody would take me. Nobody wanted me. I had too many problems. I had quite a rap sheet and had been busted for a lot of things, and even though there was war stuff going on, they did not want me in the military. And I made a deal with the recruiter. I said, I really want to go in. With a Navy recruiter. I said, and he said, here's the deal. If you stay out of trouble for like 18 months, we'll try to get you in. We'll try to get a special waiver. Well, anyway, it took about 2 years. Thank you very much. It took about 2 years of staying out of trouble. And they waved me in, and I was already an older guy by then. I was like 23. And so most of the people going in were 17, 18. And I went in and loved it. I absolutely loved it. It was the answer. I was off the streets. I've been trying to break the bonds with all the people that I knew, because I every time that I tried to straighten up at all, I would just run into somebody. And no matter what I had planned, somebody would pull something out and lay it on the table or suggest going to the store or the bar, and I couldn't say no. I would say no, and they said, "Are you sure?" "No, I'm not sure." And I would start arguing. They would say, just one. I can't tell you how many times I got really, really drunk just on one. Starting on one, and then that's all it took, was one to get started, and then I was off and running. So I get in the Navy, and Navy's good. I like it. It's the first time I ever had any discipline in my life since I was a young teenager. I'm trying to do good. I'm taking these classes, going through this electronic and radar program, computer programming, and I'm doing good. I'm learning how to, shine my shoes, press my clothes, how to do some things that I hadn't learned to do in a long time. And this is like a second chance to me, but I'm still an alcoholic, and I still like those other things. As soon as I got out of boot camp, I got in some trouble. And I stayed in for 4 years, and I got an honorable discharge. And when I was sober, I was a hell of a sailor. But I wasn't always sober. But because I did good when I was sober, I had people that were up above me that liked me and protected me. And because I was a hard worker, and I was a straight shooter, and I would tell these people up above me what happened, because I was getting in fights. And one time we stole a $500,000 yacht and took it from Virginia down to North Carolina, and just did stupid things, drunk as a skunk. There's five other people that were drunk as a skunk. And I met the second Mrs. Wright in the Navy, and she was all wrong for me, she was right for somebody but not me. But we were drinking buddies, I don't know what happened. She ended up pregnant and something in the booze. And her mother said, "What are you going to do about this? What are you going to do? What are you going to do? And what do you think I ought to do?" And she was a good old Catholic woman, and she said, "I think you ought to marry her." And I said, "Okay, I'll do that." So I got married again, and didn't want to at all, but I just did it because it seemed like I was supposed to be doing the right thing. And we had a daughter, and then I got out of the Navy, and got my discharge, and I quit drinking for 1 year. I stayed drunk for got discharged on December 5th. I stayed drunk till January to New Year's Eve. And then I made a New Year's Eve vow that I would not drink for a year. I did not drink for that year. But I smoked a lot of funny cigarettes and took some other stuff. But I didn't drink. When I didn't drink, drinking was probably the most powerful drug that I took in a lot of ways, because it's the only thing that ever made me black out. It's just about the only thing that ever made me get into fights, wreck cars, do all this stuff, you know. But 1 year later, 1 year later to the day, next New Year's Eve, I got drunk and I was back on again. And so that little sobriety experiment wasn't really sobriety, you know, but I was not drinking. And things did get a little bit better because I wasn't doing quite as crazy, but I started trying to go to school. I started trying to go to college. I was a high school dropout. I'd gotten a GED in the Navy. I started trying to go to college. I could not do that the way things were, because at some point during the day, I'd pick up a drink or one of those left-handed cigarettes or something, and I would do that, and then I would show up in class messed up, or I would forget about the class, and it was just really hard to, now I'm in like 27, 28, and I'm like, you know, 29, and it's really hard for me to go to school, and W2, it's not working out, and we're just a couple of party people. We got a second daughter now. I got two daughters, and she takes off back to Alabama, and what a hellhole. But that's another story. But no offense if you're from Alabama. I mean that in a good way. But now I've got two divorces, and my alcoholism is really getting bad. I'm drunk all the time. I've started a little business, meat and seafood business, and it's I'm really screwing it up. And it's basically I fill up a truck full of meat and seafood, and I take it out in the country, and I sell it in these little towns. It's all flash frozen, good stuff, and I built all these routes, and now I'm doing this. But as soon as I filled up my truck with stuff and head out of town to the country, I'd stop somewhere and get beer and be smoking and drinking all day long and screwing up. But then funny thing happened. I met the perfect woman, W3, she was a straight person, so she was the first straight girl I'd ever been with in my life, she was an immigrant, just come over from Russia, she was about 10 years younger than me, couldn't speak the language, which was great for me. And first time I met her, I was out by the pool, and I was exercising out by the pool and drinking beer in the morning. And I start talking to her, and she goes, "Don't you think it's early in the day to be drinking?" And I said, "Oh no, I've never been drunk a day in my life." And that's how we started our relationship, on a lie. And I told a lot more of them to her. But I had this business where I could go out of town. I could go out of town and be gone, and she didn't know what was going on. Then I'd come back into town, and I'd try not to drink around her, and that was really tough. Now I'm doing a lot of binge drinking now, but I'd screw it up all the time because I'd come back home messed up. And after a couple years of me, and I started back to school. She got me motivated to go back to school. So I'm going to Houston Community College and trying to do my deal, and really screwing up, you know. And I don't know if you've ever been in a small room when somebody came in the room that's had like 30 beers, and the whole room smells like alcohol. That's how it was when I would walk into class, you know, and the teacher hated me and the other people would be giggling and stuff, you know, and I didn't like it. And I was surly and a surly boy. But she got sick of this stuff. You know, and she got a hold, an Al-Anon got a hold of her and explained to her what alcoholism was. And she came up to me and told me that I needed to either go to AA or she was out of there. And she was serious. I'd always been able to manipulate her. I'd tell her whatever I wanted to tell her and she'd buy into it. But this Al-Anon had straightened her out in a way that I couldn't unstraighten with my bullshit. I started AA. And that was October 17th, 1984. Show up there walked in I loved it. Loved AA. Loved it. I loved the meetings. I loved the people. I loved the fellowship. I loved. I had a motorcycle, so we had a motorcycle club, and I joined that. We went riding, and then we did dinners. They had a running club, and I'd always been involved in this sport that required me to stay in shape and do some running and stuff. And so I joined their little running club, was doing that, just doing a bunch of this stuff, enjoying life. The only thing I didn't like about AA was the program of recovery, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't really care about that. I didn't really care about the sponsorship part of the thing. You know, somebody telling you what to do, that didn't sound good to me. The big book, you know. I read a lot of the literature, but I really wasn't interested in the big book. That seemed like a kind of a waste of time. But they were hounding me a lot about it. Just twisted my arm until I went and read the big book. And finally somebody said, "Have you read that book yet?" And I said, yeah, I read it. I read it last night. Read it in one night. So what did you think of it? I said, "I thought I could write a better book." So I lost a lot of friends. They didn't think that was funny. But I stayed sober and things started getting better. The ball and chain of drunkenness was gone. I wasn't fixing the inside, you know. I think Danielle said when this meeting started, you know, if you have a problem other than alcohol, I have a problem other than alcohol and it's me. And I solved that problem, me, with alcohol. You know, now I go to AA and I quit drinking. I just didn't drink. And I went to the meetings all the time. I attended meetings. I did this stuff. I got me a sponsor that wasn't really a sponsor. I played the game and went to meetings and talked the lingo. The reason that my alcoholism was untreated. The reason that I drank was untreated. I was still that guy that drank that first drink back at 13 and 14 years old. I was still that guy in a lot of ways. And so there was that inner turmoil that was, and after a few years of being sober, I was going to college full time, doing really well. Nobody could tell me what to do about AA because I thought I was doing good. First time I could go to college, I had a great business, you know, had a nice wife, nice time. House had exotic dogs, new cars, you know, motorcycle, had all kinds of toys. You couldn't tell me that I wasn't doing good. Had my own business now I'm getting degrees. And how do you tell somebody that's in that situation that they need to do something different? You know, you couldn't tell me that, you know, but they were telling me that I was going to have a fall, and I couldn't understand what they were saying. I couldn't believe it. I just thought, you know, I'm doing the right thing. I'm staying sober. And now I've got all this other stuff. Everything's working out for me. But after a few years, we moved to California, down to San Diego, W3 and I started growing apart all those years going to school. She went to school too. She became a nurse we just kind of grew apart and we had a child also. We had a child and she grew up in AA. She's now 30 years old. She turned 30 years old just the other day. We grew apart. And then I'm sitting there about 5 and a half, almost 6 years sober. And I tell myself, you know what? I probably was just a dumb country kid who was drinking too much and got into a lot of trouble and didn't understand what was going on, and I didn't understand this thing. Now I've been sober for years. You know, I've gone to school. Not the same little high school dropout that I was. You know, I could handle this booze thing. You know, as I said in the beginning, once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. I'm not cured of alcoholism, but I thought I was. And, you know, it's the great obsession of every abnormal drinker that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking. And that became an obsession of mine. And I picked up again after almost six years, and I took that first drink. And that first drink, I took only one drink. And the next day, I took two drinks. It wasn't easy. But I'm telling myself, I'm going to learn how to drink like a gentleman. And I told myself I would not drink and drive. About 3 weeks later, I woke up on the side of a road about 3 a.m. drunk because I stopped off at a bar. And I'd start slamming them down. And at some point, I passed out and I woke up on the side of the road in my car. I couldn't figure out what happened. I started this whole relapse thing. And I started drinking and I could not stop. The old timers in Alcoholics Anonymous, the ones who... did the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, the ones that had sponsors that did the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, the ones that worked out the program out of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, these people told me that over any considerable period, my disease, alcoholism, was going to get worse, not better. That I wasn't cured of alcoholism. And that someday, some way, I was going to find a way to pick up that first drink if I didn't have that psychic change that comes as a result of doing the spiritual program of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's what happened. I picked up and I was off and running. I was worse than ever. Now I don't have any control over it. I'm just drinking around the clock. I'm a 724, 365 drinker. Within 9 months, I'd picked up a couple more couple DUIs. The career that I'd worked on, getting some degrees in college, that was out the door. It'd be years before I could work in that field because of my DUIs, loss of driver's license. Now I'm on probation. You know, I got legal problems. I'm going through a divorce. It just all piled up. You know, I'd spent a lot of money that I didn't have. When I started drinking, I had a lot of credit cards. I maxed out all these credit cards. Some of these credit cards had very high limits, and I exceeded all the limits as much as possible. You know, I went absolutely nuts. A friend of mine helped 12 step me back into the program, and my last drink, you know, I was drinking on the floor hot vodka out of a bottle, swallowing Vicodin, smoking weed, and he got me into AA. I never drank again, but I couldn't leave that other stuff alone, and I went in and out of AA for another year. You know, I'd get a little bit of time, then I would relapse on something. Somebody would, you know, put something on the table. Somebody would light something up, and I would do it. And I was off and running again. And finally, on April 18th, 1992, was the last time I had any substance in my system. I was in San Diego, California, and it went absolutely nuts. I was hanging around AA. I went to the Spring Roundup, San Diego Spring Roundup, 2,500 sober alcoholics and me. And I made a fool of myself. And I don't know what anybody said there at that meeting that night. I don't have a clue what anybody said. All I know is that sometime in the morning, I didn't even know how I got home, but sometime in the morning, I'm flushing stuff down the toilet, and I've made the decision that I'm going to go to AA, and I'm going to do this thing exactly as they said. I'm going to completely give myself to this program. And I was going to find a sponsor. I was going to do whatever. I was going to find an AA Nazi sponsor, somebody that I was scared of, somebody I didn't like, somebody that had what I had that I was afraid to admit that they had it. And I went to AA for the very first time in my life on the morning of April 19th, 1992, walked into the Poway Alano Club down in San Diego and asked for help. Tears streaming down my eyes. I'd never, ever asked for help. I didn't ask anybody for help. That just wasn't my way. And the AA people that had been pissing off for a long time because of the stuff I'd been doing, you know, relapsing and coming into meetings and stuff and raising hell and saying a lot of obnoxious stuff. They surrounded me. They took me in. I got a sponsor. He had 26 years sobriety, Rick R. He's now got over 50 years sobriety. And he sponsored a lot of people, and I hooked up with him. And he said, the deal was, you know, he said, jump. I said, how far? You know, that was the way it was. I was going to do whatever he said to do. I'd lost all my kids, lost all my wives, lost all my family, had lost everything, lost my career, had lost everything. By the time I finally got back into AA that day, I'm basically within 30 days I'm homeless, I'm jobless, I'm unemployable, I'm crazy, I don't have a friend in the world, and I'm penniless, just a mess. This is how I arrived, and that's how I needed to be. Because when things were going good, I wasn't going to do it, you know. And things had to get bad enough to where I hit a bottom that I realized that all it was going to do from that point on was get worse. There was nothing going to get better. So I started doing this thing. I got into the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I started doing that first step. And I went to a step study meeting every Friday morning for the first 2 years. And I stayed on that first step. I'm still on that first step today. I'm powerless over alcohol of myself. I'm powerless over alcohol. And that fact that I'm powerless over alcohol makes my life unmanageable if I drink. So, and then they were talking, I came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And I thought about that. I said, they're saying I'm insane. Everybody seemed to agree. You know, the power greater than me could restore me to sanity. And I didn't know what to think about that. But somebody said, AA can be your higher power. AA can be your higher power. And I said, okay, AA is my higher power. And somebody said, this higher power will talk to you in meetings. These people in the meetings are talking. And so I said, okay, the people that are talking to me, that's my higher power speaking to me. And I started gravitating to the people that I knew were doing the steps. I started gravitating to the people that I knew that were doing the deal. And those were the people I was hanging out with, or listening to especially. And then that third step, you know. Turn my will and life over the care of God as I understood Him. That was a big one. That's a big one. And for a lot of people, that's a big one. Because God is a loaded word that has a lot of meanings for a lot of people. But they said, God as you understand Him. And they're very gentle about that. They weren't cramming anything down my throat. They let me do that at my own pace. I was able to think about this and say, okay, God as I understand Him. You know, I don't understand Him, but I'm going to try. And I started having a spiritual awakening by doing this thing. One day I had I couldn't sleep at night. I'm laying there on the floor of this empty apartment that I was living in. My girlfriend was gone and left me the empty apartment. And the rent was paid for about a month, so I'm sleeping on the floor. And I'm like 30, 45 days sober, and I can't sleep. And I close my eyes and I do a little prayer, and boom, something happened. You know, something happened. And I don't know how to say it, but I heard a voice. And the voice wasn't outside, it was in my head. And it was telling me that everything was going to be okay. It sounded like a father figure. Everything was going to be okay, no matter what. And instantly, I just relaxed, fell asleep. And I remember that feeling to this day. It was real. It wasn't a hallucination, because it stayed with me the rest of my life. Now, that's been 25 years. And that's been a source of great strength for me, and no matter what happens, you know. So I started having this little infant-like relationship with this power greater than myself. And then I started doing that fourth step. I did an inventory, a fearless and searching inventory of myself. I'd always been able to do a fearless and searching inventory of you. But I'd never been able to do a fearless and searching inventory of me. And I turned that around. And then I admitted my wrongs. And then I asked God to remove them. And then I started making amends. I had to make amends all over. I had to take trips down to Texas. Some people had to call because it was too far away. Made a lot of amends. And things started happening. I'm sitting in a meeting. Now, we don't read the promises here, do we? But the promises, it says, if you're painstaking about this phase of the development, step 9, make an amends, you'll be amazed before you're halfway through. And I'm sitting in a meeting during this time when I'm making all these amends, And somebody's reading the promises in the meeting, and I'm thinking about what he's reading. I'm actually listening to what he's saying. I'm not playing with a phone or whatever. And I'm thinking, wow, that happened to me. That's happened to me. That's happened to me. That's happened to me. All these promises were happening in my life, and I was absolutely amazed. It was exactly as the book was saying. And so I continued doing that. And today, you know, I live in the steps. To the best of my ability. To the best of my ability. Well, none of us are saints. No, none of us do it perfectly. Nobody maintains perfect adherence to these principles. Nobody, none of us do. Which is good, you know, but this is my life now. I'm all in, and I've stayed all in, and I plan on staying all in the rest of my life. Because I never want to go back to what I had when I got here. I never want to go back to that, you know. I'd never thought I was suicidal, but I was suicidal by the time I finally got here. And when I look back at doing that fearless and searching moral inventory, I realized I'd been suicidal my whole life. I'd always been trying to do. I played life with reckless abandon. I threw my body into every situation that I could, but it was very, very dangerous. But anyway, I am sober today. I'm recovered from that hopeless state of mind and body that I arrived here, where I could not quit taking the first drink. And once I took that first drink, I couldn't control how much. I'm recovered from that. But I'll never be cured of alcoholism. Cured would mean I could safely take a drink. I can never safely take a drink. And that's what a real alcoholic means. That's all that it means. And today, you know, I'm very, very grateful to the God that I have found and through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I would never want to go back to living life that other way. I don't apologize to anybody for my faith in God. I don't apologize for anybody. The people of faith are people of strength. And that's what I found in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I want to thank everybody that came here tonight. Thank you for keeping me sober tonight. God bless you.